You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
To the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is August 28th, 2025, very early in the morning. And we have a lot to do today because we are going to talk about the craziness with American foreign policy in Venezuela. Every once in a while, I go back to Latin America. I have a book out on the defending the military governments there. I've been dealing with the Chavez situation for some time, and then Maduro. And now I have to go back, because apparently Donald Trump wants to start another war on extremely flimsy grounds. But when are they anything other than flimsy? You know, political philosophy is not really an American strong suit. And maybe it's a blessing. You know, journalism really, when it comes down to it, is a currency of mass society. Labels fill in for reality, and superficial one-liners fill in for debate. And of course, it gets worse when the topic is foreign or obscure places, obscure to most Americans. In Venezuela, the former president, the late Hugo Chavez, and the present chief executive, Nicolas Maduro, are today called Nazis by people who couldn't tell you the first thing about the National Socialist Program. Well, that is when they're not being called communists. Often by the same people at the same time. But labels are destructive. They permit someone to believe they know something when they don't. It's the heart of superficial knowledge. Yeah, it might be useful in conversation, but as a description, it's something that throws a veil over reality. So what I want to talk about a little bit is the correction to the media and academic mythology on Venezuela, specifically today. Because the U.S. Navy has arrived off its shores. Now, during Donald Trump's first term, he came fairly close to invading, and I put that in quotes, Venezuela. Now, I don't know what exactly that means. I don't know if that means using militias. The U.S. doesn't, you know, couldn't invade Venezuela no matter what. But for now over 20 years, Venezuela has been a target of U.S. aggression. Even under the best of circumstances, the U.S. would struggle against a very well-armed and entrenched country of that size. Well, invasion won't happen because it can happen. The U.S. doesn't have the ability to take, let alone occupy, a country like Venezuela, especially for the non-reasons it gives. So other reasons have to be found. If you go back to my archives, or if you go to my Patreon page, I explain in great detail how the British lost very badly the Falklands War. But they took losses that were exhausted. And the surrender of the military government in Argentina was very suspicious. And I get into detail as to what actually happened and why. Argentina clean their clocks, use a stupid cliche. So here we are, August 29th, the overstretched U.S. Navy. They've cobbled together, I think, three destroyers, and they kind of lurk menacingly off the coast. The peace president is thinking of starting another war. And the first things that Caracas did, and this is a pretty good move, is to appeal to China for assistance. Venezuela went through a crash modernization program for its military, both under Chavez and the early Maduro administrations. And this is paying off. Now, Washington had very close ties with Venezuela before Chavez took office in 1999. Now, when I say close ties, I mean the U.S. was able to exploit the country. Chavez put a stop to this. Now, the left claims him. I say he's a national socialist. It makes perfect sense. He is both a nationalist and a socialist. Both men are. But when you're a nationalist, the socialism you espouse is very different from Marxism. I deal with that at great length in about 10 million other places. To some extent, it's uniting left and right. I don't think the left fully understands it. But by 2002, Washington organized a coup against the very popular government in Caracas, but it failed miserably. In fact, everything the U.S. has tried to do against Venezuela has failed miserably. Chavez was subjected to, I don't know how many assassination attempts, sanctions, all kinds of pressure. You know, everything was designed to make Venezuela's life, you know, the average person's life, as miserable as humanly possible. Well, he died of cancer in 2013, and it actually got worse when he was succeeded by Nicolas Maduro, who's there now. The U.S. then thought that he was a much weaker version of Chavez, but they were wrong. And it was in 2019, the first I heard of it, it was a talk of an imminent American invasion. A lot of ignorant warmongers who, you know, don't know the first thing about any kind of military doctrine or were demanding that Donald Trump intervenes. Now, I want to stop here and I want to talk about something that I don't know if I should laugh or what. In 2020, things got worse. There was something called Operation Gideon, which, by the way, now is the second blasphemy against the Old Testament judge. There was another one in the Middle East. An unsuccessful and sometimes hilarious attempt by the U.S., Venezuelan dissidents, and a private security firm, Silvercorp, USA, owned by Jordan Godreau. The point was to infiltrate Venezuela by sea and remove Maduro from power. It was set for May 3rd, 2020. And they hired, it's actually quite a complicated story, they hired a bunch of Venezuelan former military personnel living in Colombia to enter the country by boat at the port of Macuta, take control of an airfield, capture Maduro, and, you know, the country would rise up in praise and love for their liberators. Jordan Godreau is a bizarre, interesting personality. I don't think he's all there. He only had 60 men to work with, but he thought that he was going to secure the General Directorate of Military Counterintelligence, the building, neutralize the Presidential Honor Guard, secure an airfield, and it's that airfield where they would extract Maduro when they knew he was arriving there. Silvercorp would then stay on to maintain the humanitarian aid distribution. And then Godreau would arrive in Caracas and, you know, just bask in the joy and the flowers that people would throw to him. Now, it just so happens that that was one of the most fortified coastlines in the country, 20 miles next to the biggest airport in Venezuela. He cited, you know, Alexander the Great. He needs to strike deep into the heart of the enemy, he said. But he didn't have the element of surprise because he gave an interview from Florida to an AP reporter. So it wasn't like this was a secret. So he thought that he was going to, in his words, introduce a catalyst. Yes, he said, okay, 60 guys can't topple a regime, but they can inspire everyone else to do so. I should note that one of the men involved in the planning was a drug trafficker, Elkin Lopez, which is actually relevant here. Of course, it was a disaster. There are two boats that were launched from eastern Colombia towards the Caribbean coast of Venezuela. Maybe 60 Venezuelan dissidents, two American former Green Berets, employed as mercenaries by Silvercorp. And by the way, where he got the money, the capital, to not just create a private security firm, but have a branch in Colombia is a question that I really can't answer. But everyone knew about it. They were intercepted before they reached land. 6 Venezuelan dissidents in the first boat were killed, and all but 4 the invaders were captured, including 2 Americans from the second boat. And their interrogations were very public. It's very strange, though, that Goudreau never made it to Venezuela. But he tweeted statements suggesting that he was, and in fact, he tweeted things like an uprising was already occurring and that he was winning. It was almost suspiciously ridiculous. Maduro described the attack as there were terrorists that planned to kill him. It was a plot from Colombia and the United States. But only when the plot failed, as obviously it would, then the opposition to Maduro said that this was a false flag that Maduro created. I guess I do believe in false flags, after all. I think Goudreau is an unbalanced, he was a legitimate Green Beret he's actually from Canada. He was a medical guy in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he tended to romanticize himself. And this group, we are the ultimate freedom fighters seeking to restore democracy in this area. He reached Sergeant First Class. He was also a fire infantryman, indirect fire infantryman, from 2001 to 2016. I think he's a complete idiot. But that doesn't capture him fully. No pun intended. So Goudreau said that the former CIA-backed presidential hopeful Juan Guaido, who I've dealt with on this show and many other places before, and 2 of his political advisors signed a contract with him for over $200 million in 2019. Again, showing that, you know, the lovers of democracy were going to take power by force. The 2 Americans who were captured were special forces, as far as I know, Luke Denman and Arian Barry. And then once it went south, of course, both the U.S. and Colombia denied ever hearing about it, including the former presidential, now disgraced, Western-controlled frontman Juan Guaido. Now, the U.S., to cover its tracks, even arrested Goudreau for the event on the grounds of weapons trafficking, not too long after it failed. Colombia did the same with those from there. Now, it's been 5 years? No trial has taken place. You know, I get the impression that he's going to be allowed to plea under the condition he never talk about it again. I think Goudreau is also the source of the rumors that Venezuela is a source of fentanyl exporting to the U.S. You notice that fentanyl gets attached to any country the U.S. doesn't like. And then Goudreau filed a lawsuit against numerous people, which was a full admission that the U.S. and many others were behind the operation because he sued him for not paying him. Yetzi Alvarez, who was a Colombian translator for Goudreau, said that she met with officials from the FBI and DEA in Florida and informed them of these plans. The Colombians knew about it very much as well. And one of the people who they were working with was a former Venezuelan general, Cliver Acala, who fled Colombia in 2018. He's been involved in these coup attempts ever since. This poor woman, the translator, Yasi, they said that the Colombian government said they were going to protect her, but the minute she wasn't useful anymore, she was arrested. Really just a safe face. So they were arresting these people, both in the U.S. and Colombia, once the thing failed. And, of course, they denied they knew about it, which is a lie. Juan Guaido, who was CIA-backed 100%, denied any connection to this, even though his signature appears on a leaked copy of the contract with Silvercorp. The video of the opposition leader talking to Goudreau surfaced after the coup attempt failed. So there's a paper trail in his case, which can only mean the CIA was more than aware of it. And, you know, it sounds so stupid. There was no way that this could have succeeded, right? Well, let me remind you of something. A plan this stupid would be consistent with the projections and the instructions of the American intelligence community concerning its enemies, or even journalists or any elite member of the regime, because they depict Venezuela as a country dying to get out from under the boot of this tyrant. So even a small operation would allow democratic forces to take action and get rid of him. It would be a spontaneous revolt, and the Americans would enter the capital as heroes. You know, they've created this dream world, so a plan like this would make sense to them. And it has certain similarities. It has some similarity to the Kursk incursion in the Russo-Ukrainian War. Obviously, the Bay of Pigs. I just wonder if it was a test of the Venezuelan defenses along its coast. But there's no question that the U.S. government was more than aware of the operation. Now, if you remember the war criminal John Bolton, who I think has been arrested, a year before this ridiculous plan took action, he was U.S. National Security Advisor. He announced full support for Juan Guaido. He called him the legitimate president, that Maduro's re-election was completely fraudulent, although no one knows who authorized Bolton or the Americans to make any such statements as to what, you know, election is legitimate and what isn't. The U.S. wasn't really there officially as election observers. But because of both Russian and Chinese support, they both armed the country to the teeth. If that didn't happen, there may have been some kind of military action. But the sanctions, you know, there's a big difference between sanctions in Latin America and sanctions on a place like Russia or North Korea. Latin America is very dependent on the U.S. Sanctions could actually work there. Now, there was another presidential election, July of this year, and Maduro won yet again. You know, it just seems to be, it's the same thing over and over again. I'm so sick of this. It's the same, I'm saying the same things. Just, you know, that's how the regime works. That's how color revolutions work. Of course, they condemned it before it happened. The opposition at least initially called for a boycott. Now, the only reason you would boycott an election is if you think you're going to lose. If you were going to win, you would never boycott an election. There were a million ways the U.S. tried to disrupt the election beyond just refusing to accept the results. Drago Bosnić, who I've quoted many times here, he interviewed a Serbian member of parliament, Bojan Torbica, who was an election observer actually in Caracas. And he testified that, yes, Venezuela was under tremendous pressure to elect Washington's candidate, but stood its ground. The lame duck Biden administration was running out of time. The U.S., you know, again, the self-styled arbiter of a presidential election, which is very, very rich in our era of history. The opponent wasn't Guaido. It was a man named Edmundo Gonzalez, who lives in Spain. At the time, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said that he won the presidential election. He had no evidence for that. He just said it. The election was in July. The month later, Blinken posted that the Venezuelan people spoke resoundingly on July 28th and made Gonzalez the president-elect. This is coming from the Biden administration, you know, keep in mind. All the vassals of the EU and NATO, you know, rejected the elections. They didn't know. They didn't have any observers there. In fact, Blinken even said Gonzalez won by this huge margin, claiming that the NGOs he was citing, they were independent, especially the Carter Center. Well, the Carter Center was there. Unfortunately, it's funded by many government agencies, including the State Department itself. But even if that weren't true, NGOs still are in no position, especially ones based outside of the targeted countries, can determine the legitimacy of elections. That's not at least with the ones he's talking about, and that's not what they're doing. Now, when Trump was elected, Marco Rubio took his place, and of course, he supports the overthrow of Maduro as well. Elliot Abrams, he was a special envoy tasked with ensuring the success of the 2019 coup, hence, I'm certain he knew of the 2020 disaster. In fact, Rubio went so far as to call on the Venezuelan military to overthrow Maduro. That's a breach of diplomatic conduct here. I don't think Gonzalez wants to be involved in it. He just went back to Spain. He didn't do much campaigning. But let me talk about the election. I've done this in other places. Again, it just seems so repetitive. When the wrong guy gets elected or reelected, the U.S. says it was illegitimate. They cite some source from a dissident group connected with the opposition of whatever country we're talking about, and that's their authority. And then it gets repeated in major newspapers, and so then it becomes common knowledge, right? It simply wasn't true. The Supreme Court, that country, reviewed the election. And it ratified Maduro's victory to secure a third term that will end in 2031 if he survives that long. And that's one of the things that the Supreme Court down there does. Graciela Rodriguez, who was the president of the Supreme Court, said in Brazil, Mexico, and even the U.S., the Supreme Court has settled certain electoral matters. And they clearly stated that Maduro has been reelected, despite the tremendous pressure on them to say otherwise. He won 52% of the vote. And that was 43% for Gonzalez. Of course, educated at American University in Washington, D.C. If you know something about the Venezuelan election system, the electoral system, I think it's impossible to really fake it. I'll talk about that here in just 1 second. And the U.S. was involved in attacking the cyber attacks on the electoral system. And so certain parties couldn't submit their tallies, broken down by each voting center. Massive cyber attacks against state infrastructure. That was the reason why they couldn't do it. Most political parties eventually did get the information in. Enrique Marquez and Antonio Ocari didn't deliver theirs, but they're from very minor parties. And then, of course, once the Supreme Court confirmed his election, the U.S. has said, well, they're politically biased. Now, this is not an appealable ruling. Gonzalez refused, by the way, to submit anything, and he was held in contempt of court, which is one of the reasons he's staying in Spain. But the U.S.-backed opposition anywhere never recognizes its electoral defeats, and nowhere is it more obnoxious than in Venezuela. There's always a reason to spur a street protest. There's always bad things going on. It's very typical for color revolutions. U.S. Senators Rick Scott, Republican from Florida, and Jim Risch, Republican from Idaho, sponsored the Valor Act to promote democracy in Venezuela. I mean, these people are totally out of ideas, because all it is more sanctions on Caracas. I thought it was fully sanctioned, but we know what a sanction really is if you've listened to me for a long time. Venezuela has severed its diplomatic relations with a few countries, American allies, Argentina, Chile, Costa Rica, Panama, Peru, Dominica, because they are subordinate to Washington and trying to interfere in Venezuelan affairs. Now, there's one source, and you're going to laugh when I mention the source, because they are a ideological disaster. What they have to say should be listened to only because of the nature of the Venezuelan electoral system, the actual system of voting, the National Lawyers Guild. This is probably going to be the last time I'm going to cite anything good from them. They actually had people on the ground there. And they said that they witnessed no instances of fraud or serious irregularities, and even the voters were fairly satisfied with the process itself. They had five people there. There were, I think, 100 total from different countries. They went to a few polling places. Venezuela has a system that's very hard to fake, unlike the U.S. Voter turnout was 59%. The voting electorate is maybe 21 million people. But there was opposition violence at certain polling places, trying to destroy the polls and trying to block the final count, which is no surprise. This happens everywhere. Actually, I'm wrong. It was 910 electoral monitors from 95 countries around the world, overwhelmingly, but not all, overwhelmingly said that this is a fully acceptable result. Well, we know it's an acceptable result because they swept the local elections too. The ruling party, as I say, is the National Socialist Party. It's the socialist Great Patriotic Poll. Well, that's pretty much National Socialism. They swept the municipal offices on July 27th. 280 mayors out of 340 races. An increase from before. They won 309 cities overall in 2017. But then in 2017, there was a full opposition boycott, again, because they know that they would lose. They selected 2,402 local councilors, and the system is semi-proportional, so you have, in this case, 1,420 from party lists and the remaining pass-the-post candidates. So, because they swept the local elections, his party swept the elections, it's no surprise that he won the presidential election. So the opposition parties in Venezuela, they lost more than half of the municipalities they'd won in 2021. And we have to talk about Maria Machado. She's the one who initially calls for abstention. I've been talking about her for quite some time. She's an oligarch. A few places that they won, of course, as is expected. But I think it's fraud-proof, or as fraud-proof as you can get. It's called the electoral horseshoe. When you get to a voting booth, the first station, you have to run your fingerprints through a biometric ID machine. Then you're cleared. You go to the second step, and that's where a touchscreen machine is unlocked. Then you actually vote, and the machine prints a paper backup, which is crucial, confirming your choice. And that's what's deposited in the ballot box. Now you have two records. The fourth and final station, voters sign and stamp their fingerprints on the electoral record. It's actually quite interesting, and it's very hard to fake that, because you have the paper backup, and of course very few of these exist in the U.S. The biometric ID, there's no way you could vote more than once. And the total number of votes has to match the electronic tally and the electoral record. The process is witnessed by members of all the political parties who choose to have witnesses there. And then when the polls close, by law, 54% of voting machines are randomly chosen for an audit to compare the electronic totals with the paper tallies. So I don't care if the National Lawyers Guild is communist, you know, maybe, you know, they were a long time ago. They're still pretty obnoxious today, but it's really hard to fake it here. It was a fairly efficient and voter-friendly process. The polling stations that they visited and all the other ones, the Serbian guy, you know, these guys all said the same thing. Election observers were there from all the political parties, including the opposition, of course. The one polling station didn't have any, the Socialist Party didn't have any observers there. But there was general confidence among Venezuelans in the process itself. They have to open at 6 a.m. And there were some people complaining about the heat or the lines, whatever it is, but Maria Machado, whose political party is Vente Venezuela, who said everything was going smoothly. We'll see how everything turns out during the actual, you know, she didn't like the results. But for many years now, the U.S. tried to delegitimize the National Socialist State, downplaying the widespread popular support for the Maduro government and the deeply divided and oligarchic opposition as far more unified and influential than it really is. The Washington Post called Venezuela a political military dictatorship, using words like dictator, autocrat, repressive, over and over and over again. They say that about any government they don't like. It's the same words, same slogans, over and over again. They talk about Gonzalez. He's a popular, soft-spoken former diplomat, despite the fact he didn't campaign. In fact, it was Maria Machado who did most of the campaigning. Now, why didn't Machado run? Well, she has tried to overthrow the government so many times that she's not allowed to run for office. And that went all the way to the Venezuelan Supreme Court the last time in January. She was involved in the attempts to overthrow the government in 2014, 2017. Support for Juan Guaido's so-called interim presidency, or the, you know, presidency in exile. The illegal seizing of Venezuelan assets abroad, including 31 tons of gold in the Bank of England. She even supports the brutal sanctions against Venezuela. How can anyone claim to have any popularity and support sanctions in your own country? And we've heard of this before, too. And, of course, she supported the failed coup of 2019. And I should note, I'm not the only one who's done this, that Machado wrote a letter to Benjamin Netanyahu. And I don't know what she was thinking here, but she wanted Israeli military intervention in Venezuela to overthrow Maduro. But that was in 2018. I'm not so sure anyone would vote for a person like this. Now, for the first time in her life, Machado, who is an oligarch, she's the daughter of a owner of a steel conglomerate that had his company nationalized. She never really had I've been through a lot of the websites of these little tiny parties that are coming and going. You know, they rarely have actual programs. But for the first time, Machado put out an 85-page program. And you probably could figure out what her agenda is just because of who she is. Now, I don't know how many Venezuelans are going to read 85 pages. But of course, she wants to privatize everything. She wants to cut all forms of social spending. She wants to abolish free healthcare, deregulate the labor market, in other words, destroying unions, reducing all forms of worker protections, your typical austerity measures. I mean, who's going to vote for this? And even fewer is going to read it. Milei's doing the same thing in Argentina. It's weird how many of these fly-by-night parties that make up the opposition, they don't even mention a platform. Actually, on the night of the election, just hours prior to the announcement of the results, President Milei in Argentina incited violence against the Venezuelan embassy there, which is in violation of the Vienna Convention, and called again for a coup against Maduro. I said I've talked about this before. Let me quote myself here from 2019. The MUD, which is the CIA-created Democratic Unity Roundtable using its Spanish initials, MUD, is hardly a popular force. Suspiciously, most of its parties are tiny and very recently founded. Justice First is its only major party with 33 seats in the Assembly. It was founded only in 2000. National Convergence is minuscule and founded in 1993. It has zero seats. The Fearless People's Alliance is based around one person, Antonio Ledezma, who in 2015 won an award from the National Endowment for Democracy. It's only one guy. It doesn't have any seats, of course. The ecological movement for Venezuela has only a handful of members, founded in 2010. The movement for responsible, sustainable, and entrepreneurial Venezuela, apart from having the longest name among political parties there, has a defunct website. It might not even exist at all. That was just a few years ago, and it's already out of date because these parties come and go. They're created on an ad hoc basis. They have no principles. But this has come up before. Constant name changes. It's very typical. You see this in Syria. You've seen it elsewhere. The U.S. is constantly interfering in elections, especially in places like Venezuela. Now, polling data. This is something that the regime will try to tell you. The polling data was going Gonzalez's way. Sometimes they even quote exit polls. Well, exit polls are not legal in Venezuela. So anyone who talks about an exit poll here is lying. The polling companies were kind of all over the place. Some of them put, and some of these companies that have no track record at all, they place Gonzalez with a sizable lead. But then you have a pro-opposition polling company, Data Analysis, the Data Analysis Group, predicting a small Maduro victory on July 28th. But these inventions manufacture a justification for foreign intervention. Polling is notoriously unreliable there. And these companies have various biases, and they're usually connected with NGOs. But as we all know, polls, they exist to shape opinion, not reflect it. The U.S. provides direct support to opposition candidates, Juan Guaido as well as Gonzalez. In fact, the U.S. gave Guaido $3 billion in Venezuelan state funds. Now, how the U.S. can do that is interesting, but he pocketed it, and he was disgraced for it. There's a memo drafted by the U.S. Embassy, Michael Milton Steer there. CIA-backed support for opposition forces that attacked the Electoral Commission, as well as the Supreme Court and the Presidential Palace. There was an arson attack that the CIA fully admitted was, involved with, the School of Social Work at the Central University of Venezuela. The opposition trapped several dozen student supporters of Chavez in the building and set it on fire. The exact same thing happened in Ukraine, if you recall. U.S.-backed attempts at terrorism are everywhere. And we know this is true because of the terrorist groups that the U.S. finances in Syria and the Ukrainian government. Well, whatever is left there. There were six individuals the evening prior to the election, including two Colombian paramilitaries. They entered Venezuela to attack the electrical grid of several areas of the country. They were arrested. They're going to destroy the Urina electrical substation. Each bomb they had was equivalent roughly of 25 pounds of TNT. They were trying to knock out powers in as many places as possible, which is very odd something. If you think you're going to win an election, this is what you're going to do. But the attacks on electrical grids, transmission systems, media disinformation, financial support for opposition candidates, street violence, endless sanctions. This is how America fights wars there. This is how it interferes in elections. And of course, the pillar are sanctions themselves. Now, unlike in other places where Russia has, reached its height of second world status, because it's not really that connected with the U.S., well, Venezuela is a different story. The sanctions result in economic hardship in Latin America. Thinking that that's going to undermine support for Maduro, it does quite the opposite. As whoever controlled Biden, there was negotiations to lift some of the sanctions. Some of the oil sanctions were reimposed in April, but sanctions then the president has full control over sanctions. He can lift them arbitrarily; doesn't have to enforce them. I have a whole paper on this. If you know, by Patreon, I have the explaining what a sanction actually is. And of course, once the election didn't go their way, they tried to increase it. But political confusion is pretty normal here. The invention of a narrative, this broad discontent, support for opposition parties, you know. But the media refuses to talk about the way that sanctions undermine the economy. The constant incitements against Maduro, demands for a coup. And now, a $15 million bounty, which has been raised, I think, to $30 million on anyone who can get Maduro for them. It was in 2023, Trump was speaking at a press conference in North Carolina, and he said, and I'm quoting him here, "When I left office, Venezuela was ready to collapse. We would have then just taken it over. We would have gotten that oil." Well, you know, remember, it's true, the U.S. military is one of the largest consumers of oil on the planet. But Reuters says, and this is in February of this year, U.S. President Donald Trump stated that he was reversing a license given to Chevron, opens a new tab to operate in Venezuela by his predecessor Joe Biden more than 2 years ago, accusing President Nicolas Maduro of not making progress on electoral reforms and migrant returns. Now, it's true, Venezuela's oil is some of the dirtiest, but there are certain ways it can be properly, it's a little bit more expensive to filter. So on Truth Social, he said that he was reversing the concessions on the oil transaction agreement, reversing the Biden administration's granting of the license to Chevron to operate there. So Trump's idea was to implement what he calls maximum pressure. That's how he describes the sanctions policy against Venezuela. That was in his first term, and Biden pretty much did the same thing. And Trump reinstated broad oil sanctions because he won the election. And of course, this is a very good argument. You know, Venezuela, the only thing that Latin American countries can do is to join BRICS. To get away from this dependency on the U.S. despite their, you know, close proximity. Yeah, I think the bounty on Maduro's head is now $50 million for information leading to his arrest. Now, here's something else we have to talk about. Maduro supports local drug cartels. And this is particularly hilarious because there are no drug cartels in Venezuela. It simply doesn't exist. There is a fictitious Cartel of the Suns. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced on August 7th, and that's where the bounty was increased. But allegedly, now after the electoral issue, the Cartel of the Suns, which is totally fictitious, Bondi accused Maduro of heading up one of the world's most notorious drug trafficking operations. The drug trade is a threat to the national security of the United States. He even uses foreign terrorists and criminal organizations, including the Tren de Agua gang, the Mexican Sinaloa cartel, in addition to the Cartel of the Suns, to traffic cocaine into the U.S. She goes so far as to say he is one of the largest narco traffickers in the world and a threat to our national security. Therefore, we've doubled his reward to $50 million. The reality is that there's very little cocaine coming out of the country, and no cartels operate there. If anything, Chavez and Maduro have been at war with the cartels elsewhere, you know, drugs coming into the country. Because remember, they have a border with Colombia. Apparently there's some indictment, or so claims the Miami Herald. Miami Herald says that Maduro and his cartel is going to flood the U.S. with cocaine. Again, no evidence is offered, except court documents, which it will not cite. Yet, of course, as we know, any time a government successfully destroys a drug trade, the U.S. is at war with it. Philippines, Afghanistan, the Taliban has destroyed it now twice. El Salvador. And one of the reasons this is going on is precisely because the military government of Chavez had destroyed the drug trade. There's something else, but we'll get back to that here in a minute, but I want to mention something. The U.S. State Department's Human Rights Report on Venezuela. I've read it. I'll send it to my producer to maybe put it up in the show notes. Venezuela, of course, is accused of everything. But if you look at it, it doesn't look real. It's not on any official, you know, letterhead. It doesn't use any standard format. Anyone could have thrown this together. It looks rushed. It looks put together by someone who has never seen an official report before. There are no footnotes or references of any kind. It was done very quickly. It's just a list of assertions. Venezuela has been involved in arbitrary or unlawful killings. No footnote, no reference, no interview subject, nothing. Not even an explanation of how this was gathered. Actually, I read the one on Indonesia too, and they're almost identical. It's just a template that they just repeat. The format, the accusations are identical. And actually, NPR, surprisingly enough, they noticed this. But the presentation is very strange. For one thing, these reports are much shorter than under previous administrations. They used to be roughly between 9,000 and 10,000 words. It was a substantial work. Now, starting in 2022-23, it's just been, today it's just about 2,000 words. Again, very rushed. Allegedly, it's to make it more readable for the average person. But the earlier versions, you know, even though it would be nonsense all the way through for certain places, the reports provided some evidence, recommendations for action, and details, which they may be false, but certainly looks more credible than this nonsense. Looks like a hungover college student put a paper together at the last minute. But, you know, the U.S. writing human rights reports on anybody, it's just a surreal experience, given the descent of the U.S. I don't have to say anything about the Zionist aggression, the genocide that the U.S. supports, the drug cartels that the U.S. supports. And you know what one of the most bizarre accusations against Venezuela is now? That they're failing to protect refugees and asylum seekers. So apparently, people are going to this tyranny to escape some other tyranny. Venezuela has a minimum wage under the poverty line. Of course, that has nothing to do with sanctions, of course. The UN report says that these sanctions have caused over 100,000 excess deaths. People would not have died otherwise. Because of the geographic location, the dependency, sanctions can work on a place like Venezuela. All of the claims, all of these claims, these cartels, these crimes, have zero evidence behind them. I mentioned the Tren de Agua, the Aragua drug cartel, which has been dismantled years ago, the fictitious cartel of the Suns, and somehow they mentioned the Sinaloa cartel, which is in Mexico, and is notorious for being protected by the United States. Somehow this is justifying the naval presence in Venezuela today. Venezuela doesn't have any cartels, so the regime has to invent them. The Cartel of the Suns is mentioned many times. It's an invention. It's a mashup of several themes you see in movies and cartels from various parts of Latin America. It started as a rumor spread by a very small outlet. Then it was picked up by, you know, some prestigious, quote-unquote, media outlet in the U.S. In this case, it was Wall Street Journal. And from there, it was repeated by the regime's media worldwide. And eventually, it bounces back to Venezuela. And it's already endowed with this aura of truth because, you know, Wall Street Journal said it. It's an old pattern. It's a method of propaganda. Well, back in 2019, there was a hack writer from the Washington Post named Jackson Deal. Of course, that was the year of the coup that failed. And he had to come up with some reason as to why it failed. And this is where the Cartel of the Suns come up. It was invented here, but it became prominent here. He says the Colombian government, military, that's where this cartel is actually a military one, according to them, flies hundreds of tons of Colombian cocaine from Venezuelan airfields to Central America and the Caribbean for eventual distribution in the U.S. and Europe, which doesn't make any sense. He doesn't explain why Colombian or Peruvian drugs need to use another country, need to have a stop in Venezuela. Then the Maduro government is accused of skimming accounts used for importing food and medicine, corrupt currency trading. Well, you know, what's Maduro going to do? Sue him for slander? Johnson's law says he could say whatever the heck he wants. And this is how the government has survived U.S. sanctions. Now, evidence? It's very scanty. He cites an Associated Press article from 2018 reporting on an unproven allegation made by a minor U.S. Treasury Department figure, who of course was anonymous. January 2019 Wall Street Journal article that reports on another unproven allegation made by the same source of the U.S. Treasury Department and linked to one of his own Washington Post articles published in 2015. In other words, he has nothing. But Johnson's law being what it is, he can say whatever he wants. Well, it's Latin American. They have Spanish names. It's a tyranny, right? Well, I'm sure that they're exporting drugs. It sounds like it, right? When Colombia does it, well, you know, certainly Venezuela. Why wouldn't Venezuela? Peter Bolton wrote in 2019 concerning these stupid allegations. He says, over 4 years since the launch of this probe concerning, you know, these alleged cartels, the DEA and Department of Justice have yet to even charge, let alone convict, anyone implicated in it. Yet still the mainstream media reports repeat the allegations as if they were beyond question. 2018, Insight Crime published an article entitled Drug Trafficking Within the Venezuelan Regime, the Cartel of the Suns. The group claims to have built files on senior Venezuelan officials, current or past, that have been involved in the trafficking of cocaine. But rather than providing the reader with evidence that they've amassed, this mountain that they claim to have amassed, the authors instead had an anonymous Justice Department official as their source. Venezuela is just not a drug-exporting country, but the myth is needed to justify the present policy and explain why liberalism could go nowhere in this country. It's true, about 5% of Colombia's drug output will pass through Venezuelan territory. The remaining 95% comes through the Pacific route through Colombia's Caribbean coast. Involving another country doubles your chances of being interdicted. It doesn't make any sense. Now, once military spending increased under Chavez and the early years of Maduro, that even went down. The UN came out and said that there are no cartels in Venezuela, and less than 5% from Colombia goes through Venezuelan sources. The UN says that Venezuela is free of both drug crop cultivation and drug labs. Clearly, you know, these accusations, it's a total lack of credibility here. The Minister of Foreign Affairs, Yvonne Gill, says, government of the U.S. entity claims, without providing evidence, that a drug trafficking network in Venezuela is led by President Nicolas Maduro under the so-called Cartel of the Suns, which it alleges is connected to the Tren de Agua and the Sinaloa Cartel criminal organizations. Colombia's president actually mocked the Cartel of the Suns mythology. He says that it doesn't exist. This is absolutely ridiculous. And they're enemies of Venezuela. Truth is that only when Venezuela threw out the Drug Enforcement Administration in 2005 and Caracas assumed full control of the fight against drugs, whatever there was there was destroyed. Massive increase in drug seizures, enhancing internal cooperation. But again, given that the U.S. condemns any actual defeat of the drug trade somewhere, like Afghanistan, El Salvador, the Philippines, you know, the claim does make sense. You get rid of the DEA, get rid of the U.S., and you will suddenly start winning your drug war. You go back to Maria Machado. She's a dominant oligarch, opposition leader, one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential women in the world. She testified before U.S. Congress that Venezuela was the world's fourth largest producer of cocaine. This is a lie. Fed into the worn-out hoax to the Cartel of the Sun and its narco regime. Of course, she was educated at Yale and is a regular at Davos forums. But she's the one consistent figure in the oligarchy, the one consistent figure behind all of these endless parties and coalitions. Now, her 90-page agenda, as I mentioned above, clearly was written by American PR firms. I mentioned everything that she wanted to do, supporting sanctions on your own country. She even is demanding foreign intervention to remove Maduro. She is the puppet master for whoever is the so-called opposition there at any given time. Of course, Machado is in favor of same-sex marriage. By the way, there's zero support for that in Venezuela, but she is occasionally homosexual, as far as I can tell. Sometimes, when it suits her. And, of course, wants legal abortion through the courts. These are American priorities. Machado, of course, speaks English. She's not, you know, it's the same for all of these people and all these color revolutions. She expresses her immense gratitude for the harsh measures against her own country. Thousands of people of all political backgrounds were marching in protest. They didn't blame Maduro for poverty. It was they knew who it was. I wrote on her idiocy back in 2019, the earlier paper. Let me quote myself again. The opposition's main candidate and public face is Maria Cortina Machado, the daughter of a steel tycoon whose business was nationalized by Chavez. She founded several feminist political groups in the country and, of course, educated at Yale. She seems to live in North Carolina, but I've not verified this. The government accused her of approaching the military to foment a coup, and she acted outraged. Well, right on her website, in the English language section, by the way, she has an appeal to the army. Growing up in a life of indulgence and luxury has left this woman with stunted intelligence. One can't scream foul when you're implicated in fomenting a coup with clear evidence on your website. Of course, at that point, she had refused to publish the platform. As most of her coalition parties, they won't do it either. Now she's done so in this lengthy document, which no Venezuelan could ever vote for. I don't care what your political background is. Because of Venezuela's position, close to the U.S., somewhat dependent on it, sanctions can actually work in this case. I mentioned the Falkland Islands. You know, the British, that was 1982. The British couldn't do that today. They don't have the resources. They don't have the manpower. They don't have the ships. I don't think anything's going to happen here. The regime has exaggerated these, or even just fabricated these allegations. It's an aspect of economic warfare. And yet you have intelligent people who just refuse to be skeptical of corporate media reports and think that NGOs are somehow independent. Now, initially, on August 8th, President Trump ordered the Pentagon to prepare options for attacking drug cartels, designated as terrorist groups. Now, as far as it goes, that would be a good use of American military power for once. I had no problem with that at all, but corruption in this country has destroyed even that. I thought they were considered terrorists to begin with. But they weren't. This was about Venezuela. In 2018, talking about sanctions on Venezuela, this comes from the AP. Trump turned to his top aides and asked an unsettling question. With a fast unraveling Venezuela threatening regional security, why can't the U.S. just simply invade the troubled country? Now, we've come across his naivete when it comes to American military power. It's a chronic vice in Trump's presidency. I don't think a lot of people, even people who've served in the military, don't really seem to know what such a thing would require. They think of something like Panama. The bombing of Iran's nuclear sites, as I reported at the time, and is now pretty much universal, that it failed. It did very little damage. Donald Trump murdered the respected commander of the Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani, under a ruse. He was on a peace mission. Tried to attack Yemen on several occasions, again with minimal damage. Palestine. But Venezuela, like so many other countries, have long prepared for an American invasion. It's unlikely to materialize. Many of you have read that Maduro has called up the national militia. It's something that's comprised of civilian volunteers founded by Chavez in 2008, just in case something like this would happen. Plus the modernization of Venezuela's armed forces during Chavez and then in the early Maduro. And then even more after 2008, with the help of Russia and China. Venezuela is very well off in the Defense Department. Venezuela has conscription, but only a handful are actually chosen once they reach 18. So unfortunately, the designation of the cartels as terrorist cells is just an excuse to attack Venezuela, the country that has no cartels. The dominant drug gangs in Mexico will remain quite safe. Now, China has issued a warning. Members of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, they even joined some of the U.S. Allies, Brazil and Colombia, denouncing the claim of this naval buildup. Started just after August 8th. As far as I know, as of right now, at least 3 missile destroyers, maybe 3,500 Marines, are right now off the coast of Venezuela. Pentagon officials are citing the executive order designated drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. Though I don't know what 4,000 Marines are going to do. Venezuela is a substantial country. Maybe it's just an attempt to grab headlines. The ships are the USS Gravely, the USS Jason Dunham, and the USS Sampson. And I'm not really sure what naval ships would have to do with attacking drug cartels. I don't think that's a naval battle. The Venezuelan armed forces are the largest and the best equipped in Latin America. I mean, relative to their size. Venezuelan airspace is by far the best defended in South America. They're using the S-3000VM long-range air defense systems and some of the shorter-range assets. Also, the longest range fighter class, the Su-30 MK-2. It's precisely this kind of thing, it's like the Exocet missile in the Falklands that completely annihilated the British Expeditionary Force. Now, I mentioned that Maduro went to the Chinese, and here's what the Foreign Ministry spokesman said just a few days ago, August 21st. He said, China opposes any move that violates the purpose and principles of the UN Charter and a country's sovereignty and security. We oppose the use or threat of force in international relations, interference in external force in Venezuela's internal affairs under any pretext. We hope that the U.S. will do more things conducive to peace and security in Latin America and the Caribbean region. That sounds like just, it's typical diplomat speak. But you unpack it, you realize how serious it is. Much of Latin America, even America's allies there, are condemning this action. And this is the same man. Donald Trump used to be a vocal critic of regime change and color revolutions in the past. In Colombia, it was supposed to be an American ally, and he's condemned the American buildup, even using the word gringo. The gringos are mad. They think that invading Venezuela is going to solve their problems, he said. Well, apparently the civilian militia is about 7 million members, while the army remains on full alert, of course. Now, I've been through the Chavez economic miracle. The poverty rate from 1999 to 2011 went from 44% to 26%. Extreme poverty went from 17% and to 7% in that same period. Of course, American sanctions have destroyed it. Land reform was his big thing. The Ba'ath Party in Syria did the same thing. Gave land to those who could till it. The communists said that they're going to do it, but they never did it. They collectivized it instead. Venezuela distributed more than 3 million hectares. So that means in 2000, Venezuela was producing 51% of its own food. And that went up to 70% in 2011. Caloric intake went up 50% thanks to Chavez's food stores. Massive increases in meat and everything else. The malnutrition rate fell. It's really just from 21% in 1998 to 3% in 2012, according to the FAO. Nationalization of the oil company was a big deal. Nationalization of steel, as I mentioned. That permits the country to chart its own economic path. This angered the U.S., and that's why every opposition figure says, yeah, we'll sell it off to you. They're going to have subsidized energy, not just for Venezuelans, but for its allies as well. They nationalized the electrical and telecommunications sectors. Instead, they created cooperatives. The unemployment rate fell. 1998 was 15.2%, 6% in 2012. The minimum wage went up substantially. Actually, it was the highest minimum wage in Latin America. But only 13 years after Chavez took power, only 21% actually made the minimum wage. They made more than that. 6 hours a day was the normal working day. 36 hours a week, no loss of pay. Debt collapsed. Or fell, I shouldn't say collapsed. See, 45% of GDP to 21% in 2011. Why? Because Venezuela withdrew from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. They paid their debts early, just like the Russians had done. Sanctions, of course, have bitten into this. Yet again, imperial liberalism has taken a nation on the verge of first world status and thrust it back to the third world or worse. It's just tiresome. I'm sick of talking about it. The same pattern over and over again. It's the same nonsense everywhere. You have a Western educated opposition figure financed by the CIA that otherwise would have no presence at home, educated, you know, in at one of the Ivy Leagues. They're called the savior of the country. Then you have the popular ruler, hampered by American sanctions, who refuses to implement the agenda of the IMF. His economic success is never reported by the Western press. The media, bought up by NGOs that repeat American liberal slogans. Then there are elections that elect the wrong person, condemned immediately as illegitimate, despite the ruling party having no interest in faking anything. Basic questions are never asked. Why would anyone vote for a free trade regime that's destroyed country after country? Who would vote for sanctions and austerity on their own country? Who would vote for someone who demands an invasion of your own country? Why would anyone in the third world, especially a Catholic country, care about the fags at all? They all make a big deal about it. These stupid human rights reports. Go to a few countries in the third world. They all read the same way. They're templates. The blanks are filled in. I don't know who's doing this, but now I think they're pretty much high school levels of writing. Just filling in the blanks. The Chavez revolution had continued unabated. Venezuela would most certainly be a first world country, and Russia would have a major ally on America's doorstep. Washington has overthrown governments in Georgia, Ukraine, many other places to ring Russia with enemies. The U.S. pretends to be outraged when Russia replies. This is a national socialist agenda, not a Marxist one. The CELAC organization, or the Union of South American Nations, that was based on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's internationalist, but the stress is on the national, not the inter. And of course, the infamous Bank of the South idea from Chavez, where Latin America would then be independent of the U.S. dollar. It gets just depressing. The same things. It's the same arguments I have every time with people. Just parroting the corporate NGO propaganda packages news. The only real schism in global politics is between nationalism and liberal globalism. When I say nationalism, I'm talking about national socialism. So I wind this up. There's a naval presence. You know, the U.S. kind of cobbled together three ships trying to intimidate Caracas, and it's failed. There's not going to be any invasion. It would take 100 times the men and material to even start that. Now, with the U.S. used militias, its cartel allies, and covert operations against the ruling National Socialists, it's very possible. But now the peace president yet again is trying to start a war using the color revolution technology. He, by the way, has now refunded USAID. He said he was going to defund it. It's now been refunded. In foreign policy, Donald Trump is part of the swamp. Now, if you know, immigration stuff, we support him to the extent that we can. But in terms of foreign policy and international political economy, he is part of the swamp. And it gets worse and worse and worse. It gets less and less rational. The wounded animal lashes out. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.